He crossed the street and took the sidewalk until he stood in front of it. Little patch of perfect green grass, the front porch under the shadow of an old pine tree, on the mailbox a last name he didn't recognize. He put his hands on the picket fence. It was dusk. Lights just beginning to wink on in the houses all around him, the occasional snippet of conversation sliding through a raised window. The valley silent and cooling, and the highest elevations of the surrounding mountains catching the last bit of daylight. He unlatched the gate, pushed it open, walked up an old stone path to the porch. The steps creaked under his weight. Then he stood at the front door. He could hear voices on the other side. Footsteps. A part of him didn't want to knock. He rapped his knuckles on the glass of the outer door, took a step back, waited a full minute, but no one came. He knocked harder the second time. Footsteps approached. He heard a lock turn. The wood door swung open. That broad-shouldered man looked at him through the glass. "Can I help you?" Ethan just needed to see her up close, under the porch light, confirm it wasn't her, that he wasn't going mad. Move on with his myriad other problems in this town. "I'm looking for Kate." For a moment, the man just stared at him. Finally, he pushed open the glass door.
"Who are you?"
"Ethan."
"Who are you?"
"An old friend." The man stepped back into the house, turned his head, said,
"Honey, could you come to the door for a minute?"
She responded with something Ethan couldn't make out, and the man said,
"I have no idea."
Then she appeared, a shadow at the end of a hallway leading into the kitchen, passed briefly through the illumination of an overhead light, and padded in bare feet through the living room up to the door. The man stepped aside, and she took his place. Ethan stared at her through the glass door. He shut his eyes and opened them again. He was still standing on this porch, and she was still, impossibly, behind the glass. She said,
"Yes."
Those eyes, unmistakable.
"Kate?"
"Yes."
"Hewson?"
"That was my maiden name."
"Oh my God."
"I'm sorry. Do I know you?"
Ethan couldn't take his eyes off her.
"It's me," he said.
"Ethan.
I came here to find you, Kate."
"I think you're confusing me with someone else."
"I'd know you anywhere. At any age."
She glanced over her shoulder, said,
"It's fine, Harold. I'll be in a moment."
Kate opened the door, stepped down onto the welcome mat. She wore cream-colored pants and a faded blue tank top. A wedding ring.
She smelled like Kate, but she was old.
"What's happening?" Ethan asked. She took him by the hand and led him over to the swing at the end of the porch. They sat. Her house stood on a small rise with a view of the valley, the town. House lights were everywhere now, and three stars had popped. A cricket, or a recording of a cricket, chirped in one of the bushes.
"Kate."
She put her hand on his leg and squeezed, leaned in close.
"They're watching us."
"Who?" "Shh." She motioned toward the ceiling, a slight upward gesture with her finger, whispered,
"And listening."
"What's happened to you?" Ethan asked.
"Don't you think I'm still pretty?"
That snarky, biting tone was pure Kate. She stared down into her lap for a minute, and when she looked up again, her eyes glistened.
"When I stand in front of the mirror and brush my hair at night, I still think about your hands on my body. It's not what it used to be."
"How old are you, Kate?"
"I don't know anymore. It's hard to keep track."
"I came here looking for you 4 days ago. They lost contact with you and Evans and sent me here to find you."
"Evans is dead." The statement appeared to have little impact. "What were you and Bill doing here?"
She just shook her head. What's going on here, Kate?
I don't know.
But you live here?
Yes.
For how long?
Years.
That's impossible.
Ethan stood, his thoughts swarming.
I don't have answers for you, Ethan.
I need a phone, a car, a gun if you have. I can't, Ethan.
She stood.
You should go.
Kate, right now.
He held her hands. That was you when I lost consciousness on the street last night. He stared down into her face, laugh lines, crow's feet, and still so beautiful.
Do you know what's happening to me?
Stop.
She tried to pull away.
I'm in trouble, he said.
I know.
Tell me what, Ethan, now you're putting my life at risk. And Harold's. From who?
She tore away from him, started toward the door. When she reached it, she looked back and for a moment, standing out of the light, she could have been 36 years old again.
You could be happy, Ethan. What are you talking about? You could have an amazing life here. Kate!
She pushed open the door, stepped inside.
Kate!
What?
Am I crazy?
No,
she said.
Not at all.
The door closed after her, and then he heard the deadbolt turn. He walked to the door and stared at his reflection in the glass, half expecting to see a 60-year-old man, but he was unchanged. He wasn't hungry anymore. He wasn't tired. Moving down the steps, down the stone path, and onto the sidewalk, he only felt this tightness in the center of his chest, a familiar sensation that used to hit him just before a mission, walking out to the chopper as the ground crew loaded the 50-cal Gatling gun and the Hellfires. Fear. Ethan didn't see a car until the next block, a mid-1980s Buick LeSabre, its windshield plastered with dried pine needles and sitting on four tires that could have used some air. The doors were locked. Ethan crept up onto the porch of the closest house and lifted a stone cherub from its perch under a window. Through the thin curtains he saw a young boy inside, seated at an upright piano, playing some gorgeous piece of music, the notes drifting out onto the porch through a 4-inch crack where the window had been raised off the sill. A woman sat beside him, turning pages of sheet music. Though only a foot tall, the cherub was solid concrete and weighed in excess of 30 pounds. Ethan hauled it back out into the street. There was simply no way to do this quietly. He heaved it at the window behind the driver's seat, the angel punching easily through. He unlocked the door, pulled it open, climbed inside over the shattered glass, over the seats and behind the wheel. The impact had decapitated the angel, and Ethan grabbed its head out of the back seat. Two blows were sufficient to crack open the plastic sheathing under the steering column and expose the ignition cylinder. The light inside the car was bad. He worked solely through feel, fingers tugging out the power and starter wires. The piano playing inside the house had stopped. He glanced toward the porch, saw two silhouettes now standing behind the curtain. Ethan fished the pocket knife out of his jacket, opened the largest blade, and cut the pair of white wires he was betting fed power to the car. Then he shaved the plastic sheathing off the ends and twisted them together. The dashboard lit up. The front door to the house swung open as he found the darker-colored starter wire. A boy's voice.
Look at the car window.
Ethan shaved some plastic off the end of the starter wire, exposing the threads of copper. The woman said,
Wait here, Elliot.
Please, please, please. Ethan touched the starter wire to the power wire, a blue spark crackling in the darkness. The engine coughed. The woman was moving toward him through the yard.
Come on, Ethan said.
He touched the wires together again and the engine turned over. Once, twice, three times. On the fourth, it caught and sputtered to life. He revved the RPMs, shifted into drive, and punched on the headlights as the woman reached the passenger side door, yelling through the glass. Ethan sped off down the street.
At the first intersection, he turned left and backed off the gas pedal, reducing his speed into the realm of reason, a pace that wouldn't draw attention. Somebody out for a nice evening drive. The gas gauge showed a quarter of a tank remaining. Reserve light not yet on. Not a problem. There was enough fuel to blow out of Wayward Pines. Once he got over the pass, there was a one-stoplight town about 40 miles south, Loman, Idaho, right on the highway. They'd stopped there for gas on the way out. He could still picture Stallings by the pump in his black suit, filling the tank. Ethan had walked out to the edge of the empty highway, stared at the abandoned buildings across the road. A shuttered roadhouse and general store, and one diner, still alive but barely kicking, the smell of grease in the smoke that trickled out of a vent on the roof. He'd called Teresa from that spot with just a single bar of connectivity. Barely remembered their conversation. His mind had been elsewhere. Last time he'd spoken to his wife. He hoped he'd told her he loved her. The brake squealed as he brought the Buick to a full stop, left turn signal clicking. Aside from a handful of people on the sidewalks, the downtown was dead, and Main Street empty as far as he could see. Ethan eased out into the road through a gentle left turn and accelerated slowly, heading south. He passed the pub, the hotel, the coffee shop. After 7 blocks, the hospital. There were no outskirts. The buildings simply ended. He accelerated. God, it felt good to be going, finally getting out, a palpable weight lifting off his shoulders with every revolution of the crankshaft. He should have done this 2 days ago. There were no signs of habitation here, the road on a straight trajectory through a forest of pines so giant they could have been first growth. The air rushing into the car was cold, fragrant. Mist hovered between the trees and in places across the road. The headlights blazed through it, visibility dropping. The reserve light came on. Shit. The road south out of town was on a steep and winding grade for several thousand feet up to the pass, and any minute now the climb would begin. It was going to burn through what little gas remained. He should turn around now, head back into town, siphon enough to ensure he reached Loman. Ethan hit the brake for a long, sharp curve. The mist was soup through the heart of the turn, the fog blinding white in high beams, Ethan slowing down to a crawl with nothing to guide him but the faded double yellow. The road straightened, shot out of the mist, out of the trees. In the distance, a billboard. Still an eighth of a mile back, all he could make out were four painted figures standing arm in arm. Big, white teeth smiles. A boy in shorts and a striped shirt. Mother and daughter in dresses. The father suited, wearing a fedora, waving. In block letters, under the perfect smiling family, "Welcome to Wayward Pines, where paradise is home." Ethan accelerated past the sign, the road moving parallel to a split rail fence, the headlights grazing over a pasture and a herd of cattle. Lights in the distance. The pasture fell away behind him. Soon he was passing houses again. The road widened, lost the double yellow divider. It had turned into First Avenue. He was back in town. Ethan pulled over to the curb, stared through the windshield, trying to keep the panic in check. There was a simple explanation. He'd missed the turnoff to the pass, had shot right past it in that patch of dense fog. He whipped the car around and burned back up the road, hitting 60 by the time he reached the pasture. Back in the mist and the towering pines, he searched for a sign, for some indication of where the road veered off toward the pass, but there was nothing. In the sharpest section of the curve, he pulled off to the side of the road and shifted into park. Left the car running, stepped out into the night. He crossed to the other side and started walking along the shoulder. After 100 feet, the fog was thick enough to hide his car completely. He could still hear it idling, but the sound grew softer with each step. He walked 200 yards before stopping. He'd come to the other side of the curve, where the road straightened out again and ran back into town. The rumble of the car engine had died away completely. There was no wind, and the woods stood tall and silent. Mist drifted by all around him, seemed to carry an electric charge, but he knew that hum was only some microscopic noise within himself, in his head, exposed only in the total absence of sound. Impossible. The road should not turn here. It should barrel on through these pines another half mile and then begin the long series of switchbacks up the side of that mountain to the south. He stepped carefully down off the shoulder into the trees, the pine needle floor of the forest like walking on cushions, the air damp and chill. These trees. He'd never seen pines so tall, and with little in the way of undergrowth to contend with, moving between the massive trunks was easy, a forest with breathing room. You could be lost before you knew it. He walked out of the mist, and now, when he looked up, glimpsed icy points of starlight through the tops of the trees. Another 50 yards, and he stopped. He should go back now. There were certainly other roads out of town, and he could already feel the disorientation creeping in. He glanced back over his shoulder, thought he saw the general route he'd taken to arrive at this spot, but you couldn't be sure. Everything looked the same. Out of the woods ahead of him, a scream. He became very still. There was the thumping of his heart, and nothing else. The scream could only be compared to human suffering or terror, like a hyena or a banshee, coyotes at their maddest. The mythologized rebel yell, high and thin, fragile, terrible, and on some level humming under the surface like buried electrical cables, was a dim awareness that this wasn't the first time he'd heard it. Again, the scream. Closer. An alarm going off between his eyes, in the pit of his stomach. Leave this place now. Don't think about it. Just go. Then he was running through the trees, gasping after 20 steps, back into the mist and the cold. Up ahead, the ground sloped upward, and he climbed on hands and knees until he'd stumbled back out into the road. Despite the cold, he was sweating, eyes stinging with salt water. He jogged along the double yellow line, back through the curve, until he saw two cylinders of light in the distance, cutting through the mist. Slowed to a walk, and above the noise of his exertion, he heard the idle of the stolen car. He reached it, opened the driver's side door, climbed in behind the wheel, put his foot on the brake, and reached for the gear shift, desperate to leave this place. He caught movement out of the corner of his left eye, a shadow in the side mirror. His eyes cut to the rearview mirror above the dash, and in the red glow of the brake lights, he saw what he'd missed. The cruiser parked 30 feet behind his rear bumper, just shy of complete invisibility in the mist. When he looked back through the driver's side window, a shotgun barrel stared him down just a few inches away. A flashlight blazed inside, firing the interior of the car with a harsh light that glared off the chrome and glass.
You must be out of your goddamned mind.
Sheriff Pope. The irate gravel in his voice came slightly muffled through the glass. Ethan still had his hand on the gear shift, wondering if he jammed it into drive and floored the gas, would Pope fire on him? At this range with a 12-gauge, you were talking decapitation.
Very slowly, Pope said. Put both hands on the wheel and use your right to turn off the car.
Ethan said through the glass, You know who I am, and you ought to know better than to interfere. I'm leaving this town.
The hell you are.
I'm an agent of the United States government with full
no. You're a guy with no ID, no badge, who just stole a car, who might have murdered a federal agent.
What are you talking about?
I won't tell you again, partner.
Something needled Ethan to comply, whispered that pushing this man could be dangerous, even fatal. All right, Ethan said. Just give me a second. The car's hot-wired. I have to separate the wires to turn it off.
Ethan flicked on the dome light, got his hands under the steering column, pulled the white wires apart. The lights died. The engine shut down. Nothing but the painful brilliance of Pope's flashlight.
Out.
Ethan found the handle, had to dig his shoulder into the door to jar it open. He stepped outside. Mist streamed through the light beam. Pope, an angry shadow behind the flashlight and the shotgun, eyes hidden under the brim of his Stetson. Ethan smelled the gun oil, figured Pope for a man dedicated to the tender, loving care of his armory.
"You remember that part where I told you not to leave town?" Pope growled.
Ethan would have answered, but the light beam struck the ground, Ethan realizing a split second before it hit him that the shadow moving toward his head was the stock of the shotgun. Ethan's left eye had been closed by the blow. It felt hot and huge, and it throbbed with his pulse. Through his right, he saw the interrogation room, claustrophobic and sterile. White cinder block walls, concrete floor, a bare wood table, on the other side of which sat Pope, sans Stetson and jacket, the sleeves of his hunter green button-down rolled up to expose his forearms, thick and freckled and knotted with muscle. Ethan wiped away the fresh line of blood sliding down the side of his face, oozing out of the gash above his left eyebrow. He stared at the floor.
"May I have a towel, please?"
"No. You can sit there and bleed and answer my question."
"Later, when this is all over and you're out of prison, I'm going to invite you over to my house to see your badge. It'll be behind glass in a frame, hanging over my mantle."
This elicited a radiant smile.
"Think so, huh? You assaulted a federal agent. That's a career ender. Tell me again, Ethan, how exactly you came to know about the body in 604, and none of this vanishing bartender bullshit."
"What are you talking about?"
"The truth. What I told you is the truth."
"Really?
You want to keep heading down that path? Because I went to the pub."
Pope drummed his fingers on the tabletop.
"They don't even have a female bartender on staff, and nobody saw you there 4 nights ago."
"Somebody's lying."
"So what I'm wondering is, why'd you really come to Wayward Pines?"
"I told you."
"The," in air quotes, "investigation?"
Ethan took a deep breath, felt the anger rattling in his chest like sand in a bleached-out skull. His head was killing him again, and he knew it was in part owing to the trauma to his face, courtesy of Pope. But it also felt like that old, familiar pounding at the base of his skull that had plagued him ever since he'd woken by the river, not knowing who or where he was. And there was something more, the disconcerting déjà vu surrounding this interrogation.
"There's something wrong with this place," Ethan said, the emotion gathering like black clouds in his chest, accumulation of 4 days' worth of pain and confusion and isolation. "I saw my old partner this evening."
"Who?"
"Kate Hewson. I told you about her. Only she was older. At least 20 years older than she should have been. How is that possible? Tell me."
"It ain't."
"And how can I not make contact with anyone on the outside? How is there no road out of town? Is this some kind of experiment?"
"Of course there's a road out of town. You got any idea how goddamn crazy you sound?"
"There's something wrong with this place."
"No, there's something wrong with you." "I have an idea."
"What?"
"How about I give you a sheet of paper? Let you have some time to write down everything you want to tell me. Perhaps I'll give you 1 hour to do it."
The offer chilled Ethan. Pope continued,
"Or maybe you'd answer my questions faster if I were wearing a black hood, or if I hung you up by your wrists and cut you. Do you like being cut, Ethan?"
Pope dug his hand into his pocket,
tossed Ethan something across the table. Ethan said, "You had it?" He lifted the wallet, flipped it open. Secret Service credentials in the clear plastic sleeve, but they weren't his. The badge had been issued to William V. Evans.
"Where's mine?" Ethan asked.
"Yeah. Where? William Evans, Special Agent, Secret Service, Boise Field Office? How again did you know it was him in the abandoned house?"
"I told you. I was sent here to find him and Kate Hewson."
"Oh, that's right. I keep forgetting. I called your agent Hassler in Seattle, by the way. He'd never heard of you."
Ethan wiped more blood out of his face and leaned forward in his chair.
"I don't know what you're trying to do. What game?"
"My theory, Agent Evans had been pursuing you. Finally caught up with you here in Wayward Pines. So you kill him and kidnap his partner, Agent Stallings, intending to flee town in their car. Only on the way out, a little piece of bad luck catches up with you, and you get into a car accident. Stallings is killed, you take a hard blow to the head. Maybe it jars a screw loose, and when you wake up, you actually start believing you're this Secret Service agent."
"I know who I am."
"Really? You don't find it odd that no one can locate your identification?"
"Yeah, because it's deliberately being..."
"Right. We're all involved in some big conspiracy." Pope laughed. "You ever consider that maybe no one can locate the badge of Ethan Burke because it doesn't exist? Because you don't exist?
You're insane."
"I think you may be projecting, partner. You killed Agent Evans, didn't you?"
"No.
You sick, psychopathic nutjob. Beat him to death with what?"
"Fuck you."
"Where's the murder weapon, Ethan?"
"Fuck you."
Ethan could feel the ire exploding within him. Pure, flammable rage.
"See?" Pope said. "I don't know whether you're just a damn good liar, or if you actually believe this elaborate lie you've constructed."
Ethan stood, unstable on his feet. A deep blossom of nausea spreading in the pit of his stomach. Blood poured down his face, dripping off his chin into a tiny pool on the concrete. "I'm leaving," Ethan said, motioning to the door behind the sheriff. "Open it." Pope didn't move, said,
"You go on and sit back down now before you get yourself really hurt."
Said it with the confidence of a man who had many times done the thing he was threatening, who would gladly do it again. Ethan stepped around the table, moving past the sheriff to the door. Tugged on the handle. Locked.
"Sit your ass back down. We ain't even started yet."
"Open the door."
Pope rose slowly to his feet, turned, and crowded into Ethan's airspace. Close enough now to smell the coffee on his breath, see the stains on his teeth. He had 4 inches on Ethan and probably 40 pounds.
"Do you think I can't make you sit down, Ethan? That it's beyond my ability to do such a thing?"
"This is an illegal detainment."
Pope smiled.
"You're thinking all wrong, boy. There's no such thing as law or government inside this room. It's just you and me. I am the one and only authority in your little world whose borders are these walls. I could kill you right now if I wanted to."
Ethan let the tension knots in his shoulders relax, lifting both hands, palms out, in what he hoped Pope would mistake for a sign of deference and defeat. He drew back his head, dipped his chin, said,
"Okay, you're right.
We should keep talk," and came off the balls of his feet like they'd been spring-loaded, driving the plate of his forehead straight into Pope's nose.
Cartilage crunched, and Ethan felt blood gushing down into his hair as he scooped Pope by his cedar-planked thighs, lifting with his legs, the sheriff struggling to catch Ethan's neck between his biceps and forearm, but too late. The heels of Pope's boots slipped out from under him, greased with some blood that had slicked the floor, and Ethan felt the man's substantial weight go airborne. He dug his shoulder into the man's stomach and drove him down hard onto the concrete. A burst of air exploded out of Pope's lungs, and Ethan sat up, straddling the sheriff as he cocked back his right arm for a palm heel strike. Pope torqued his hips and drove Ethan's face into the leg of the wooden table with enough velocity to split open his cheek. Ethan fought to get up amid the motes of excruciating light that starred his vision, but as he got his legs underneath him and struggled to stand, he saw that he'd righted himself a second too late. Ethan might have parried the haymaker if his head was clear, his reflexes primed, but in his current state, he reacted at half speed. The force behind the blow made Ethan's head swivel far enough that he felt his thoracic spine pop. Found himself dazed and prone on the surface of that wooden table, staring up through his one good eye at the maniacal sheriff descending for another blow, his broken nose mushroomed across his face like something that had detonated. Ethan raised his arms in an effort to protect his face, but the sheriff's fist ripped easily through his hands and crashed into Ethan's nose. Tears streamed out of his eyes, blood into Ethan's mouth.
"Who are you?"
the sheriff roared. Ethan couldn't have answered if he'd wanted to, his consciousness slipping. What he could see of the interrogation room beginning to spin, interspersed with snapshots of another. He is back in that brown-walled room with the dirt floor in the Golan slum, watching a bare light bulb swinging over his head as Asif stares at him through a hood of black cloth that reveals only a pair of brown, malevolent eyes and a mouthful of smiling teeth too white and perfect to be a product of any fourth world, Middle Eastern shithole. Ethan dangles by his wrists from a chain bolted into the ceiling, his feet just close enough to the floor to ease the circulation-destroying pressure by rising up on his big toes. But he can manage this for only seconds at a time before his phalanges collapse under his weight. When they finally break, he will have no means by which to stop the loss of blood flow to his hands. Asif stands inches from Ethan's face, their noses almost touching.
"Let's try a question you should have no problem answering. What part of America are you from, Chief Warrant Officer Ethan Burke?" the man asks in excellent English that is tinged with a UK accent.
"Washington."
"Your capital?"
"No, the state."
"Ah, you have children?"
"No."
"But you are married?"
"Yes."
"What is your wife's name?"
Ethan doesn't respond, just braces for another blow. Asif smiles.
"Relax. No more punches for now. You are familiar with the saying, 'A death of a thousand cuts'?"
Asif holds up a single razor blade that gleams under the light bulb.
"It comes from a Chinese execution method abolished in 1905, called Ling Chi. Translated also as slow slicing or the lingering death."
Asif motions to the briefcase sitting open on a nearby table, lined with hard, black foam upon which rests a terrifying collection of cutlery that Ethan has been trying to ignore for the last 2 hours. Pope struck Ethan again, and along with the smell of his own blood, the blow jarred loose the memory of the smell of old, rotted blood on the floor of that torture house in Fallujah.
"You will now be taken to a room, given a pen, a piece of paper, and 1 hour. You know what I want," Asif says.
"I don't."
Asif punches Ethan in the gut. Pope punched Ethan in the face.
"I'm growing tired of beating you. You know what I want. How could you not? I've asked you 20 times now. Tell me you know. Just tell me that."
"Who are you?" Pope yelled.
"I know,"
Ethan gasps.
"1 hour,
and if what you write down does not make me happy, you will die by Ling Chi.
Asif takes a Polaroid out of his black dishdasha. Ethan shuts his eyes, but opens them again when Asif says,
"Look at this or I'll trim away your eyelids."
It is a photo of a man in this very room, also hanging from the ceiling by his wrists. American, probably a soldier, though impossible to know. 3 months of combat, and Ethan has never seen mutilation approaching this.
"Your countryman is alive in this photograph," his torturer says, a hint of pride creeping into his voice.
Ethan tried to open his eyes to see Pope. He felt himself on the brink of losing consciousness, wanting it both for the alleviation of his current pain, but more to block the perfect image his mind had conjured of Asif, of that torture room.
"The next person who hangs from the ceiling will see a similar Polaroid of you," Asif says. "Do you understand? I have your name. I also have a website. I will post pictures of what I do to you for the world to see. Maybe your wife will see them too. You write down everything I want to know, which up until now you have held inside."
"Who are you?"
Pope asked. Ethan let his arms fall to the side.
"Who are you?"
No longer even trying to defend himself, thinking, "There is a part of me that never left that room in Fallujah that smelled like rancid blood." Willing the coup de grace from Pope that would mercifully knock him unconscious, kill the old memories, kill his present agony. 2 seconds later it came, a blow that connected with his chin and brought a burst of white-hot light like a flashbulb going off. Chapter 6. The dishwasher was loaded and groaning through its wash cycle, and Teresa, well past the point of total exhaustion, stood at the sink drying the last serving dish. She returned it to the cabinet, hung the towel on the fridge door, and hit the light. Moving through the dark living room toward the staircase, she felt something latch onto her, far worse than the emotional fallout of this long, long day. A swallowing emptiness. In a few short hours the sun would rise, and in many ways it would be the first morning of the rest of her life without him. This past day had been about saying goodbye, about scavenging what little peace she could find in a world without Ethan. Their friends had mourned him, would certainly always miss him, but they would move on, were already moving on, and would inevitably forget. She couldn't shake the sense that beginning tomorrow, she would be alone, in her grief, her love, her loss. There was something so devastatingly lonely at the thought of it that she had to stop at the foot of the steps, put her hand on the banister, and catch her breath. The knock startled her, kicked her heart rate up a notch. Teresa turned and stared at the door, the thought crossing her mind that she'd imagined the sound. It was 4:50 a.m. What could anyone possibly want? Another knock, harder than the first. She crossed the foyer in bare feet and stood in her tiptoes to see through the peephole. Under the illumination of the porch light, she glimpsed a man standing on her stoop under an umbrella. He was short, completely bald, face an expressionless shadow under the dripping canopy. He wore a black suit that made something catch inside her chest, a federal agent with news of Ethan? What other reason could there possibly be for someone to knock on her front door at this hour? But the tie was all wrong. Striped blue and yellow, too much style and flash for a Fed. Through the peephole, she watched the man's hand reach out and knock once more.
"Mrs. Burke," he said. "I know I'm not waking you. I saw you at the kitchen sink a few moments ago."
"What do you want?" she said through the door.
"I need to speak with you."
"About what?"
"Your husband."
She shut her eyes, opened them again. The man was still there, and she was wide awake now.
What about him? She asked.
It would be simpler if we could just sit down and talk face to face.
It's the middle of the night, and I have no idea who you are. There's no way I'm letting you in my house.
You will want to hear what I have to say.
Tell me through the door.
I can't do that.
Then come back in the morning. I'll speak with you then.
If I leave, Mrs. Burke, you will never see me again, and trust me, that would be a tragedy for you and for Ben. I swear to you, I intend you no harm.
Get off my property or I'll call the police.
The man reached into his coat and took out a Polaroid. As he held it up to the peephole, Teresa felt something break inside her. It was a photo of Ethan lying on a steel operating table, naked under clinical blue light. The left side of his face looked deeply bruised, and she couldn't tell if he was alive or dead. Before she knew what she was doing, her hand was reaching for the chain and turning back the deadbolt. Teresa pulled the door open as the man collapsed his umbrella and leaned it against the brick. Behind him, a cold, steady rain laid down an undercurrent of white noise on the sleeping city. A dark-colored Mercedes Sprinter was parked a few houses down. Not a fixture on her street. She wondered if the van was his.
"David Pilcher," the man said, extending his hand.
"What have you done to him?" Teresa asked, not taking it. "Is he dead?"
"May I come in?"
She moved back as Pilcher stepped over the threshold, his black wingtips glistening with beads of rainwater.
"I can take these off," he said, gesturing to his shoes.
"Don't worry about it."
She led him into the living room, and they sat down across from one another, Teresa on the couch, Pilcher on a wooden, straight-backed chair she'd dragged over from the dining room table.
"You hosted a party here tonight?"
he asked.
"A celebration of my husband's life."
"Sounds lovely."
She suddenly felt very tired, the light bulb over her head almost too much for her retinas to bear.
"Why do you have a picture of my husband, Mr. Pilcher?"
"That doesn't matter."
"It does to me."
"What if I were to tell you that your husband is alive?"
For 10 seconds, Teresa didn't breathe. There was the noise of the dishwasher, of rain falling on the roof, of her throbbing heart, and nothing else.
"Who are you?" she asked.
"It doesn't matter."
"Then how can I trust—"
He held up a hand, his black eyes crinkling.
"Better to listen right now."
"Are you with the government?"
"No, but again, who I am isn't important. It's what I have to offer you."
"Ethan is alive?"
"Yes."
Her throat tightened, but she held herself together.
"Where is he?"
She could only whisper. Pilcher shook his head.
"I could sit here and tell you everything, but you wouldn't believe me."
"How do you know?"
"Experience. You won't tell me where my husband is?"
"No.
And if you ask me again, I'll get up, walk out that door, and you'll never see me again, which means you'll never see Ethan again."
"Is he hurt?"
She could feel a compacted mass of emotion beginning to loosen behind her sternum.
"He's fine."
"Do you want money?"
"I can—" "Ethan isn't being ransomed. This has nothing to do with money, Teresa."
Pilcher scooted forward, now sitting on the edge of the chair and staring at her through those piercing black eyes whose intensity suggested a massive intellect behind them.
"I am extending to you and your son a one-time offer."
Pilcher reached into the inner pocket of his coat, carefully removed a pair of half-inch glass vials containing a clear liquid, and set them on the coffee table. They'd been plugged with microscopic corks.
"What's that?" Teresa asked.
"A reunion?"
"A reunion?
With your husband?"
"This is a joke."
"No, it's not."
"Who are you?"
"My name is all I can give you."
"Well, it doesn't mean anything to me. And you expect me to—" "What? Drink that down? Just see what happens?"
"You are welcome to refuse, Teresa."
"What's in the vials?"
A short-acting, powerful sedative. And when I wake up, I'm magically back with Ethan?
It's a little more complicated than that, but generally speaking, yes.
Pilcher turned his head, glanced toward the front windows, and then refocused his gaze on Teresa.
It will be light soon, he said. I need your answer.
She took off her glasses, rubbed her eyes. I'm in no condition to be making a decision like this.
But you must.
Teresa pushed against her legs and came slowly to her feet.
That could be poison, she said, pointing at the table. Why do you think I'd want to hurt you?
I have no idea. Maybe Ethan got mixed up in something.
If I wanted to kill you, Teresa, he stopped himself. You strike me as a person adept at reading others. What does your gut tell you? That I'm lying?
She walked over to the mantel, stood there studying the family portrait they had made last year, Ethan and Ben in white polo shirts, Teresa in a white summer dress, everyone's skin photoshopped to perfection and features sharp under the studio lighting. At the time, they'd laughed at how cheesy and staged it had all turned out, but now, standing here in the pre-dawn stillness of her living room, being offered a chance to see him again, the photo of the three of them brought out a lump in the back of her throat.
What you're doing, she said, her eyes still fixed on her husband, if it's fake,
is as cruel as it gets.
Offering a grieving widow a chance to see her husband again?
She looked at Pilcher.
Is this real? She asked.
Yes. I want to believe you, she said.
I know.
I want to so badly.
I understand it's a leap of faith, he said.
You come tonight, she said, of all nights. When I'm tired and drunk and filled to bursting with thoughts of him. I would guess that's not by accident.
Pilcher reached out and lifted one of the vials, held it up. She watched him. She took a breath in and let it out. Then she started walking across the living room toward the staircase.
Where are you going? Pilcher asked.
To get my son.
You'll do it then. You'll come with me?
She stopped at the base of the stairs and looked back at Pilcher across the living room.
If I do this, she said. We will have our old life back?
Pilcher said. What do you mean by old life?
This house? This city? Your friends?
Teresa nodded.
If you and Ben choose to come with me, nothing will ever be the same. You will not see this house again. So, in that sense, no.
But I'll be with Ethan. Our family will be together.
Yes.
She started up the stairs to wake her son. Maybe it was the exhaustion, maybe the emotion, but it felt so surreal, the air electric. There was a part of her screaming in the back of her mind what a fool she was, that no sane person would ever consider such a proposition. But as she reached the second floor and moved down the hall toward Ben's room, she acknowledged that she wasn't sane. Wasn't operating on the basis of logic or reason. She was broken and lonely, and beyond everything else, she missed her husband so much that even the uncertain possibility of a life with him, with their family reunited, might be worth signing everything else away. Teresa sat down on Ben's bed and shook his shoulder. The boy stirred.
Ben, she said, wake up.
He yawned and rubbed his eyes. She helped him sit up.
It's still dark, he said. I know. I have a surprise for you.
Really?
There's a man downstairs. His name is Mr. Pilcher. He's going to take us to Daddy.
She could see Ben's face glowing in the soft illumination of the nightlight beside his bed. Her words had hit him like a blast of sunlight, the fog of sleep fast dissolving away, an alertness crystallizing in his eyes.
"Daddy's alive?" he asked.
She didn't even know if she fully believed. What had Pilcher called it? A leap of faith.
Yes. Daddy's alive. Come on. We need to get you dressed.
Teresa and Ben sat down across from Pilcher. The man smiled at the young boy, extended his hand, and said,
My name is David. And you are?
Ben.
They shook hands.
How old are you, Ben?
7.
Oh, very good. Your mother explained to you why I'm here.
She said you were going to take us to my daddy.
That's right.
Pilcher picked up the tiny glass vials and handed them to Teresa.
It's time, he said. Go ahead and pull out the stoppers. You have nothing to fear, either of you. It will take 45 seconds once you've swallowed it. The effect will be sudden but not unpleasant. Give Ben the vial containing the smaller dose, and then take yours.
She pinched the cork between her fingernails and uncapped the vials. A potent waft of some foreign chemical escaped into the air. Smelling it somehow made it real, jarred her out of the fugue state that had controlled her for the last several hours.
Wait, she said. What's wrong? Pilcher asked.
What the hell was she thinking? Ethan would kill her. If it was only her, maybe, but how could she risk her son?
What's wrong, Mama?
We're not doing this, she said, putting the caps back in the vials and setting them on the coffee table.
Pilcher stared at her across the table.
You're absolutely sure about this?
Yes, I just can't.
I understand.
Pilcher gathered up the vials. As he stood, Teresa looked at Ben, tears shimmering in the boy's eyes.
You go on up to bed. But I want to see Daddy.
We'll talk about this later. Go on.
Teresa turned back to Pilcher.
I'm sorry.
The word stuck in her throat. Pilcher held a clear oxygen mask to his face with a thin supply tube snaking down into his jacket. In his other hand, he held a small aerosol canister. She said,
No, please.
A blast of fine mist exploded out of the nozzle. Teresa tried not to breathe, but already she could taste it on the tip of her tongue, liquid metal tinged with sweetness. The mist clung to her skin. She felt her pores ingesting it. It was in her mouth, far colder than room temperature, like a line of liquid nitrogen trailing down her throat. She wrapped her arms around Ben and tried to stand, but she had no legs. The dishwasher had stopped, and the house stood absolutely silent save for the rain drumming on the roof. Pilcher said,
You are going to serve a more valuable purpose than you could ever conceive of.
Teresa tried to ask him what he meant, but her mouth seemed to freeze. All the color drained from the room, everything disintegrating into varying shades of gray. And she could feel an unstoppable heaviness tugging her eyelids down. Already, Ben's little body had gone slack, his torso fallen across her lap, and she stared at Pilcher, who was now smiling down at her through the oxygen mask and fading toward darkness along with everything else. Pilcher took a walkie-talkie out of his coat and spoke into the receiver.
Arnold? Pam? I'm ready for you.
Chapter 7
Ethan, I need you to relax. Do you hear me? Stop struggling.
Through the fog, Ethan recognized the voice, the psychiatrist. He fought to open his eyes, but the effort only produced slits of light. Jenkins peered down at him through those wire-rimmed glasses, and Ethan tried to move his arms again, but they were either broken or locked down.
Your wrists have been handcuffed to the railing on your bed, Jenkins said. Sheriff's orders. Don't be alarmed, but you're having a severe dissociative episode.
Ethan opened his mouth, instantly felt the dryness of his tongue and lips like they'd been scorched by a desert heat.
What does that mean? Ethan asked.
It means you're having a breakdown in memory, awareness, even identity.
The real concern here is that the car accident triggered it, and that you're having these symptoms because your brain is bleeding. They're getting ready to roll you into surgery. Do you understand what I'm telling you?
I don't consent, Ethan said.
Excuse me?
I don't consent to surgery. I want to be transported to a hospital in Boise.
It's too risky. You could die before you got there.
I want out of this town right now.
Jenkins vanished. A blinding light bore down on Ethan's face from overhead. He heard Jenkins' voice.
Nurse, calm him down, please.
This?
No, that one.
I'm not crazy, Ethan said.
He felt Jenkins pat his hand.
No one's saying you are. It's just that your mind is broken, and we need to fix it.
Nurse Pam leaned over into Ethan's field of vision. Beautiful, smiling, something comforting about her presence, and maybe it was just rote familiarity, but Ethan clung to it nonetheless.
My goodness, Mr. Burke, you look simply awful. Let's see if we can't make you just a pinch more comfortable, okay?
The needle was Goliath, the biggest Ethan had ever seen, its end dripping silver beads of whatever drug the syringe contained.
What's in there? Ethan asked.
Just a little something to steady those jangled nerves.
I don't want it.
Hold still now.
She tapped the antecubital vein on the underside of his arm, Ethan straining so hard against the steel bracelets he could feel his fingers turning numb.
I don't want it.
Nurse Pam looked up and then leaned in so close to Ethan's face he could feel her eyelashes splay across his when she blinked. He smelled her lipstick, and at close range could see the pure emerald clarity of her eyes.
You hold still, Mr. Burke,
she smiled.
Or I'll jam this motherfucker straight into the bone.
The words chilled him, Ethan squirming even harder, the handcuff chains rattling against the railing.
Don't you touch me, he seethed.
Oh, so you want to play it this way? The nurse asked.
Okay. Her smile never fading, she altered her grip on the syringe, now holding it like a knife, and before Ethan realized her intention, she stabbed the needle into the sidewall of his gluteus maximus, the needle buried to the syringe. The searing pain lingered as the nurse strolled back across the room to the psychiatrist.
You didn't hit a vein? Jenkins asked.
He was moving too much.
So how long before he's under?
15 tops. Are they ready for him in the OR?
Yeah. Roll him out.
Jenkins directed his last comment to Ethan as he backpedaled toward the door.
I'll be by to look in on you after they finish the cutting and pasting. Good luck, Ethan. We're gonna get you all fixed up.
I don't consent, Ethan said with as much force as he could muster, but Jenkins was already out of the room.
Through his swollen eyes, Ethan tracked Nurse Pam's movement around to the head of his gurney. She grasped the railing, and the gurney began to move, one of the front wheels squeaking as it wobbled across the linoleum.
"Why aren't you respecting my wishes?" Ethan asked, struggling to control his voice, trying for a softer approach.
She made no response, just continued to roll him out of the room and into the corridor, which stood as empty and quiet as ever. Ethan lifted his head, saw the nurse's station approaching. Every door they passed was closed, not a shred of light filtering out from under any of them.
"There's no one else on this floor, is there?" Ethan asked.
The nurse whistled a tune to the rhythm of the squeaky wheel.
"Why are you doing this to me?"
he asked, and there was a note of desperation in his voice that wasn't staged, which sourced straight from the wellspring of terror that was mounting steadily, moment by moment, in the pit of his stomach. He stared up at her, a strange angle from his prone position on the gurney that showed the underside of her chin, her lips, her nose, the ceiling panels and long fluorescent light bulbs scrolling past.
"Pam," he said, "please, talk to me.
Tell me what's happening.
She wouldn't even look down at him. On the other side of the nurse's station, she released the gurney, let it roll itself to a stop, and walked on toward a pair of double doors at the terminus of the court.